This podcast is being recorded on the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay respects to elders past, present and emerging and acknowledge their ongoing connection to land, waters and culture. Colonization and genocide are ongoing processes that continue to this day. Sovereignty was never ceded. This always was and always will be Aboriginal land.
Hello and welcome back to Auspol Snack Pod, the podcast where we bring you bite-sized chunks of Australian politics and news with a side of crispy memes. And of course, we are the official podcast of the Auspol Shitposting Facebook group. My name is Noon. On Facebook, I'm Uno Funkenstein. I'm the admin and creator of Auspol Shitposting. And with me, as always, is my co-host.
Hey, Zach LeSnack.
Welcome back, Zach. And I just wanted to say, you know, thanks for doing this show with me. I have a great time. And you always bring challenging ideas, like different ways of thinking about it that I wouldn't, and it's real good. I really enjoy doing it. I like getting your perspective. I like having this chat with you. It's a good time.
I appreciate that, Noon. Thanks. Mm-hmm. I like being the dunce to your smart guy. That's feels good. Also, you missed an opportunity to say welcome back, Lesnack. So
yeah,
but that's you know, well, that's, you know, why you keep me around.
Exactly. You got to. I need this sort of professional development that you provide
for the comedy fire. Yeah. Oh, I'm about to bring some real fucking highbrow content later in the podcast as well.
Zach is almost asleep right now. He's working off a little 7-day hangover.
I am not doing well. I am very fuzzy. I had a very enjoyable holiday, but it's been an extremely protracted recovery period, and right now my lips are like covered in sunburn scabs and it makes it actually kind of painful to talk. So I hope that you guys can hear my pain. Before we kick off properly, we also wanted to thank some patrons. We got a new patron this week, Nissa. Thank you so much for signing up. Really appreciate it.
We believe it's pronounced Nissa. We're not entirely sure about that because last week we got a new patron who we thanked as Leela, but in fact they sent us an email saying that that is not their name and that it's actually Lila, and did a very good job of pretending to be offended by it, which we appreciated. So thanks, Lila. Thanks for and I hope I'm saying that right now, but yeah, and thanks Nissa, or Nisa as the case may be.
And also thank you Allison, who is signed up as a patron in combination with their partner and who we sent a special little $10 patron prize to, not realizing that in fact it was a split patronage and that Allison deserved at least 50%, if not more, of the credit.
Yeah.
So
so thanks for listening. Thanks for supporting the show.
Thank you very much.
And we hope you enjoy half of your $10 patron reward.
Okie dokie. We'll get into our entree now. This is not something that I want to spend a huge amount of time talking about because it makes me quite angry.
Yeah.
And I always, whenever I start a segment by saying that, we always end up talking about it for like 15 minutes.
Well, yes, because the horrible shit always needs to be, you know,
you got to get
discussed
into it a bit more.
Yeah.
But yeah. But so this week, the government's family law inquiry kicked off. This is something that was being pushed for by Pauline Hanson, and basically the government gave her as
as a
horse trade, basically, for her political cooperation. And I think it was around the time, actually, of the ensuring integrity bill,
yeah,
the union busting bill that the government tried to pass last year towards the end of the year. And then Hanson eventually did a surprise betrayal at the last minute on the floor and cost the government like a really embarrassing loss, which was amazing. So that's what happens when you do deals with Pauline Hanson, you fucking idiots. Like, anyway, so Pauline Hanson obviously has a long history of saying a whole bunch of flagrantly incorrect and offensive stuff about the family law
system. Dangerous, yeah.
Yeah, actively dangerous stuff. And she was saying all this stuff like when she was calling for the inquiry, and now that the inquiry is happening, and she is, I think, the deputy chair, and Malcolm Roberts is also on the committee, the other First Nations...
One Nation Senator.
Yeah, great. Doing great, Zach. Really crushing it. They're using this as an opportunity to once again just relitigate the same dangerous lies and myths that surround family law courts and parental custody in general, insisting that women lie, mothers lie in order to get custody of their children, which has been proven to be false time and time again, that women drive men to violence, which obviously is an extremely nonsense. Dangerous idea, yeah. and total bullshit. And insisting that there is, in general, a bias against fathers in the family law court system, which is, as we've discussed in a previous episode, is completely untrue.
And that, in fact, the conservative governments over the years have, like, steadily eroded the family law courts and other agencies and so on specifically to give a sup to men.
Yeah.
And in ways that are dangerous and bad for the well-being of the children. We actually did a full mains on this about the time that the inquiry was awarded to Pauline Hanson, so maybe we'll put a link in the show notes or something if you want to go back and get a bit more about that.
Yeah, we go into detail about the fact that all legitimate organizations who advocate on behalf of the victims of family violence have actually said that the system needs urgent reform in order to deprioritize co-parenting,
yeah,
and giving custody to both parents, because it is time and time again putting kids in the custody of violent parents. Fathers, men, not euphemize. So this has been an extremely disappointing and enraging continuation of this absolutely fake narrative that fathers are being hard done by the family law system. And, you know, this is obviously Pauline Hanson's pet project. And we know that she has, you know, or we can guess that she has some personal reasons to do this, because her son has had custody of his children taken away.
And she used parliamentary privilege to accuse her son's ex-partner of lying and, like, provoking him and all this other shit.
Yeah. It's not just conjecture about her personal life. This is something that she's actually actively entered into the political conversation, is her personal experience with it. But so this is her pet project, but ultimately it was the government that gave her this, and they are the people that we need to hold accountable for this. In a week when Hannah Clark's funeral was held. So, you know, like, the fact that this is where the government has allowed the national conversation about this to go, and in fact, like, actual resources, and it's so kind of upsetting and frustrating, because, and not only was another inquiry not needed, because we've had so many all saying the same thing, that the system needs to be reformed in order to deprioritize co-parenting, that we got a new one, and it's just like saying the same incorrect, flagrantly misogynist shit over and over again.
It's also Catherine Murphy, I'm fairly sure, wrote an article in which she was basically like, this was a bad call for the government, because not only did they not get their, like, horse trade with the Ensuring Integrity Bill, but that this isn't even, like, a proven vote winner for the coalition to be, like, shitty to women who have experienced domestic violence, or, like, being shitty to the children whose fathers are violent or whatever, that there's not votes in it for them. It was literally only a horse trade, and they failed that.
Yeah, but it's purely ideological. It's not, as you say, it's not even politically that expedient.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so very disappointing stuff. I will just mention before we get off the topic that Larissa Waters, the Greens senator, is also on the committee, and she has been firing back and asking hard questions, questioning all of these flagrantly
witnesses,
erroneous claims that are being made by First Nation. Fucking hell. One Nation senators, and also the MRA witnesses that they keep calling.
You showed me a good quote of someone from an actual organization with, like, Men's Rights Association or something like that.
Yeah.
And it's a woman who runs it.
Sue Price.
And someone asked her, like, she said, women are always lying in family courts, blah, 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 blah. And Larissa Waters was like, and have you talked to any women about that? And she was like, no, I don't talk to women. I talk to men. Men all tell me that women are liars. Like, genius fucking witness.
Yeah, and that's been a pattern across the hearings, that Pauline Hanson as well has been like, yeah, I know that there's no evidence for what I'm saying, but I've talked to fathers. So great to know that fathers are being listened to. Excellent job, government. Excellent job, Pauline Hanson. Let's probably move on to our actual First Nations story, not One Nation. I'm so sorry. That's so bad to mix those two things up. It's really, I'm not doing well. I'm sorry.
But, you know, in another sense, maybe this is not a First Nations story, because it's all about money that should have been going to First Nations that didn't. Mm. So this is something that's come out about Nigel Scullion, who was the Minister for Indigenous Affairs before the last election in 2019. And in the, like, I think it was 6 weeks before the election, he gave away over $500 million of grants. And these were grants that were supposed to be going towards helping improve Indigenous development of various sorts. So like increased employment, increased investment in First Nations communities, all this sort of stuff. And I'm sure our listeners will be shocked to know that this Liberal cabinet minister gave away money from grants to people who shouldn't have gotten it. Oh my God. Yeah. So there were 12 projects that his department were like, yeah, these people are not eligible. Don't give them the money, that he gave them the money. And there were 28 projects that the NIAA, which is the National Indigenous Australians Agency, said, these are 28 really important projects that should get the money. So there were things like school nutrition programs. And one that struck me as being like particularly useful and valuable that would have been funded, that would have been great, is cadetships for First Nations people in the legal aid system. Because as we know, having First Nations people being the like contact for support for other First Nations people who are in legal situations just makes such a big difference to how the outcomes, so how good the outcomes are for those people who are in those situations.
For sure.
But of course, Nigel Scullion didn't fund any of those useful programs. What he did give money to was Twiggy Forrest's mining company, Fortescue Metals. He gave money to Wes Farmers. He gave money to the Brisbane Broncos for a girls' academy and to another NRL team for a boys' academy. And, you know, maybe if I want to, like, be completely naive, I could imagine that some of that money went to hiring Indigenous people, but it seems like mostly it just went to the
businesses.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
These motherfuckers just cannot help themselves.
They really can't.
They just...
I mean, I think with this and sort of the sports rorts as well, which were both before the election, that the government thought they were going to lose. They thought there was like a 0% chance that they were going to get in. And so they were just like, fuck it,
we're on the cash fire hose.
Like, just give it all out now and then like,
yeah,
we'll deal with it in 4 years or whatever.
Coalition fire sale.
Yep.
Take the grants.
Just take the entire government budget. Yeah, it's pretty upsetting, pretty awful. It looks like there's now going to be some kind of inquiry into this, so maybe this will be the new sports rorts.
Great. That doesn't sound fucking exhausting at all.
No, and as we know, the like government has been held accountable for their corrupt activity so far, so I'm sure they will be for this as well. Heavy sarcasm there, listeners.
It's the same fucking story over and over again.
Yeah.
And it does start to feel a little bit like you're banging your head against a wall trying to follow this stuff. Like, so much of the conversation around sports rorts now is like focusing on this, on these kind of like really minute legal questions, like whether or not Bridget McKenzie's office had the legal authority to issue the grants or whatever. Why the fuck are you talking about that?
Yeah.
Like, it's so obvious. It's flagrant, blatant corruption. It's been proven over and over again. She's been stood down over it's just, but I think if there's also this like, I don't know. I guess it stems from this obsession, and partially that this is something that's fueled by the media as well, of like, oh no, if we can just prove that they actually broke the rules, then it goes to show that the system itself isn't broken and actually we do have a strategy in place to deal with this
checks
stuff.
Checks and balances.
As opposed to the reality, which is just, it's a literal fucking free-for-all. And
yeah.
If you like slick enough not to get caught, which you don't have to be that slick.
No.
You have to be pretty fucking not on the ball
in order to get caught up with this shit.
Then you can just do whatever the fuck you want.
Yeah.
Money earmarked for improving the lives of First Nations people. Yeah, I'm just going to give that to literally Coles.
Yeah, and to fucking Twiggy Forrest, who's leading the push for the cashless welfare card that's going to hurt Indigenous communities and people. Yeah. And who is going to get paid for that as well. He, like, fucking owns the cashless welfare card company. Anyway. It's all pretty upsetting. But, you know, don't worry, listeners. I'm pretty sure the government's learned their lesson. They're probably not going to put hundreds of million dollars into any more dodgy slush funds with poorly accountable decision-making processes. So
no.
I wouldn't worry about that.
Yeah. Anyway, now to take a big sip of coffee and see what we've got on the schedule for the rest of the episode.
Yeah. We will get back to that. But why don't we have a little palate cleanser with...
You fucked up.
You want to tell us about who fucked up, Zach?
Boy, do I.
Yeah, you do.
We have a returning champion.
Yeah.
Fast becoming my favorite entrant in this category. New South Wales Police Minister David Elliott. Great job, David. Congratulations on your second win. Let's go for the hat trick in 2020. Yeah. I'm sure that we can make it happen. You might remember David Elliott from his previous win in this category for shirt fronting a 17-year-old over a slight car bingle and then telling him that he was a cop.
Which he is not.
He's not. And so, yeah, he impersonated a police officer.
Again, sorry, just to go back to, like, if you can get away with it, you can do it. The police were like asked to investigate it, and they were like, "Yeah,
he obviously did it, but like, what do you want us to do about it?
Yeah,
do we look like we give a fuck? Because we definitely don't give a fuck. Because David Elliott also notably around the time that the statistics about who the New South Wales police was strip searching came out, and it came out that they were strip searching a whole bunch of kids. David Elliott, who has kids, was like, "Hey,
I hope they strip search my kids." Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So he is an all-around cool,
and
smooth
stable
operator.
Genius.
Cool, stable genius. So he's being investigated again by the police, this time for a couple of photos that were posted up on his own official Facebook page in 2018 of himself at a gun range holding an illegal firearm. And I just want to point out that he's holding it by the magazine, not by the handle, which is some real, like, 8-year-old boy with a plastic gun from the $2 shop,
yeah,
acting like a tough guy type shit. Like, he's obviously, and he's just got this weird macho thing going on, this dude, where he's, like, obsessed with the idea of looking powerful and manly and insisting that he's more powerful than he is, and you, like, tap him lightly on the shoulder, and he's like, "Oh, no, it was all bullshit and lies."
It's also funny, like, so he was the corrections minister when this photo got put up, and now he's the police minister. But I think it's like the occasional moments that we've seen him sort of rear his head into the public discourse, I can just 100% imagine what the conversation was with the premier of him being like, "I just want the cops. I want the guns. Just give me something with guns and cops, cool uniforms."
This dude guaranteed has every single Steven
Seagal film.
Can I get a job
where I see people being
film.
Beaten? Yeah, absolutely. And like, he
yeah,
just
please
wants
give
to
me
be
some
a
manly
cop.
Shit. He just wants to be a cop so desperately. But so anyway, the photos are of him at a firing range that is run by Correction Services,
yeah,
New South Wales, and he's holding an illegal firearm. And the cops are now investigating.
Holding
it wrong as well. So he's now called for an investigation of the gun range, basically.
Yeah. Which is a good idea because, like, so as this article by Ben Doherty points out on The Guardian, it's illegal for them to have this gun. Like, there are certain things, like he's allowed to fire guns that he's not licensed for at a range, but he's not allowed to fire
prohibited firearms,
which this is. So it's like, I do think it's important that the cops should be investigating this firearms range, the shooting range, because they shouldn't have that gun there or be letting fucking anyone,
yeah,
including
they have
the police
a whole
minister.
Bunch of literally illegal submachine guns
yeah,
lying
yeah.
around. And the other thing about this photo is that, like, standing next to him is obviously it's like the gun range person,
yeah.
and they're watching him, standing by, watching him while he is firing an illegal weapon incorrectly. Like, I don't know what the fuck is going on at
yeah.
Correction Services New South Wales. I mean, we do know.
they're committing loads of crimes
this
and
the,
assaulting people. That's the whole thing.
The,
so,
like, yeah, this is where all of the, like, oh, you know, all of the, as you say, all of the worst fascists, like, or, you know, people with fascist aspirations are naturally going to gravitate towards these departments.
Yeah.
So, look, it makes perfect sense that there are a bunch of macho fuck-ups who are not even worthy to shine Steven Seagal's boots. And I fucking hate Steven
yeah,
Seagal.
Yeah, he seems
so,
like a terrible person.
He's not a good guy. Yeah. All right.
Cool.
That's probably yeah. enough on that. Stupid idiot. There's not a lot good happening in Australian politics
yeah.
At the moment, so it's nice to occasionally just like
be able to laugh at some of it
yeah.
at least.
And
yeah.
for that, you know, I congratulate David Elliott.
We're looking forward to a long career of sweeping the you fucked up stakes. So.
Great job, David. Moving on. Thanks now a it's bunch. Time for...
It was the best of
takes.
It was the blurst of
takes.
You stupid monkey!
This is a blessed take, which is a nice change of pace. This is a one-panel comic illustrated by Sam Wollman, who is a leftist illustrator of note, and the words are written by Miro Sandev. So it's a picture which you may have seen floating around on Twitter and Facebook.
Yeah, got a lot of traction.
Of a whole bunch of hands reaching in, trying to grab a toilet roll, and on the toilet roll is written this. The images of working people fighting each other over toilet paper shouldn't fill you with feelings of contempt or superiority because you're not stooping to that. It should fill you with a profound sadness at what capitalism can do to people when alienation overwhelms us. A profound sadness, but also a rage at the system that produces this behavior and a desire to smash it. Don't laugh at those people. Don't call them stupid. Think about what you're doing to build a system in which scarcity is no longer an issue.
Yeah, hear him. Yeah.
Which I think is a great sentiment. And a powerful response to a lot of the social media conversation and mainstream media conversation around the public response, I suppose, coronavirus and COVID-19. Obviously we have seen this very strange phenomenon of people panic buying toilet paper,
yeah,
which started a little while, like pretty early on in the piece. And it's like easy comedy fodder, right?
Toilet paper is a funny object. Like
it's already funny.
Yeah.
And you know, you've got everybody on Twitter, like, why toilet paper?
Yeah.
Such a strange thing to do. And I'm sure that part of it is, you know, probably a couple of people did it and everybody else was just like, well, fuck. All the toilet paper is going to be gone. I need toilet paper. I should get some too.
Like panic buying is a weird example of rational decision making by individuals that like aggregates to be not rational as a whole. Like there's no reason why everyone should buy toilet paper, but then when someone starts doing it, it becomes the sensible thing to do, to go and get like whatever fucking rolls you can find.
Yeah. It is strange walking down supermarket aisles you know, wasn't even there for toilet paper. I was just like, I better pick some up while I'm here. And then there being like almost none left. It is quite strange. But I think I really love this response because it's so empathetic. And it's about understanding the way that capitalism does force us, backs us into these corners where people do start to behave in this kind of absurd or ridiculous or comical fashion. And you know, this piece, I think, captures so succinctly the fact that that is kind of a tragedy. And it's not something that, you know, the response in times like this should be one of compassion and not one of ridicule or mocking, because
it's not helping at all. And
talking about a population that feels like so disempowered and so unprotected by their government that like, this is the way that they respond. And there is something deeply tragic about that. And it should inspire you to, as Sam and Mira say, to smash the system and do something about it, not just sit back and have a laugh and think, aha, I would never succumb to such like to the zeitgeist like that. You know, I'm not part of a mob. You know, I'm a rational figure, unlike these people. Like, don't separate yourself from them. Realize that you've got more in common with them than you do with anybody who's dictating the way that your life is lived. Sorry, go on.
No, I was just going to say, I think this isn't like an original hot take or anything, but the difference between how we've been in this country treating each other in the face of this crisis compared to how we did with the bushfires. And I feel like I'm not entirely sure why this one the COVID crisis has resulted in this like individualized, atomized panic and everyone out for themselves thing, where the bushfires had this sort of communality to them and like this solidarity. And I think maybe part of it is the international angle that like during the bushfires, it was like Australia's thing and the entire world was looking at us and being like, damn, that fucking sucks.
Yeah.
Whereas now there's no one paying attention to Australia except Australians, because it's an international crisis. But also I think maybe there's something about bushfires as part of our national identity, and like for all that it's bullshit when climate deniers say that bushfires have been here forever or whatever, but like they have, and it is a part of this continent and this land that I think maybe COVID feels like sort of ironically like sterile and impersonal and external thing. But it, yeah. Anyway, I
think there's something. The way that this that it's been framed is kind of is strongly individualized, I guess, you know, this is what you're saying, that obviously that we kind of had this communal response and like people coming together and helping each other for the bushfires, but bushfires are seen as this problem for the community, right? Whereas I think that coronavirus has made people afraid for their own personal safety, like I am going to get infected, and this is kind of manifested in a number of different ways, and one of the more disturbing ones I think is that a lot of the discourse around it that I've seen on social media has been like, don't panic, don't worry, you don't need to be worried, it's only immunosuppressed people or the elderly or people who have, you know, pre-existing comorbidities that need to be worried. In other words, don't worry, it's only vulnerable people that are going to be hurt by this.
It's only really the poor and the elderly and the people who can't afford
treatment. Normal person shouldn't be worried about this. And I think that kind of really fucked up response is in response to this attitude of like, oh, people are worried about themselves. They're not worried about the community in this crisis. They're worried about it happening to them. And so it makes sense to these people to try and soothe that anxiety by saying, no, you'll be fine individually.
Yeah.
And I think you're right that it is a starkly different like social response, and it has been kind of sad to see that sort of throwing under the bus, I suppose, of these marginalized communities.
Yeah.
We know that, like, I mean, I guess, and we'll get into this a little bit later, but that, like, it's important to understand these kinds of crises as stresses that expose the pre-existing weaknesses in our social safety net, basically. And we'll get into a little bit more detail with that.
As Zach has alluded to, we've already started snacking on our main course. We just had a couple bites, but why don't we just award our shit post of the week first, and then we'll get back into our our main course.
So we did a bit of scrolling when we were prepping for this episode, trying to find a shit post of the week, and considering how much hilarious shit has happened this week, I mean, Peter Dutton literally got fucking coronavirus.
Yeah. And there were some memes about that, most of which were sort of horrifying. Not to say I disapprove, but didn't exactly want to give the award.
Yeah, look, I think in general, it's very important that we show each other solidarity, empathy, and compassion in this time, and that we shouldn't be punching down. On the other hand, it is extremely funny that Peter Dutton got coronavirus, and you're allowed to laugh at it. Anybody trying to do civility politics discourse at this point, like, we're better than that or whatever. Well, I'm not. Fuck that. And we have anointed ourselves official arbiters of what is funny in Australian politics.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
And our official declaration, we're giving it the Auspol stamp of being amusing. Peter Dutton getting coronavirus.
Definitely funny.
Definitely fucking funny.
But it is now time for
Shitpost of the Week.
We didn't find any OC that we liked, but there was a tweet that I just completely lost my shit at that I wanted to share. So I showed it to Noon, and I was like,
It's going to take too much explaining.
Yeah, it's going to take way too much explaining. And Noon was like, you should do it anyway.
Yeah, So buckle in, listeners. Get ready for an explanation of a convoluted meme.
So let's start with the tweet, which is from a tweeter called Carpe Bohemian. And the tweet goes, Tom Hanks and Rita Wilson, we have coronavirus. Chet Hanks. And then this video plays.
Oh, be a sister, no devil, no dopey. Everything gonna be iry.
So, for anybody who didn't recognize that,
including me,
that quote, that is Brad Pitt. Teen heartthrob Brad Pitt in the Hollywood blockbuster smash hit Meet Joe Black, which I'm not going to go into a huge amount of detail in. You should not watch the whole thing because it goes for 3 hours. It does feature in a hilarious scene where Brad Pitt gets hit by two cars and dies, which is great. Then death inhabits his body and takes a holiday, basically. Like, the being, death, takes a holiday in Brad Pitt's body. And it's a really, really boring movie. But it has this scene where, for some reason, Death in Brad Pitt's body decides to speak Jamaican patois to a black grandma in a hospital. And it is a hilarious piece of cinema history.
Objectively very funny.
So what the fuck does this have to do with Tom Hanks getting coronavirus? Well, I need to tell you about Chet Hanks, a.k.a. Chet Hayes. So Tom Hanks has three sons. He's got one son, Colin Hanks, who is an actor of some repute. You may have seen him in the movie Orange County, also in the first season of the Fargo TV show, which is way better than it had any right to be. He's got a second son who, for the purposes of this story, I've deliberately not learned their name. And he's got a third son, Chet Hanks, a.k.a. Chet Hayes, who is a budding rapper slash actor and has all sorts of just fucking awful tattoos all over his body. And
that's not an anti-tattoo dig, by the way. That's an anti-Chet Hayes' tattoos.
Yes, yes. No, yeah. Tats are just great. To be clear. Chet Hayes has abused the medium.
The technology of the tattoo.
Yeah. This is not what it was for, Chet. So Chet Hayes, Tom Hanks' young son, recently went viral for posting this video of himself at the Golden Globes early this year.
Oh my God. Big up the whole island massive. It's your boy Chetana coming straight from the Golden Globes, you watching? Me see my father Tom Hanks presenting in a while, tune forward come. Big up, tune in.
I love you. You'll note that
you should watch the video as well. He's having such a good time being this fucking idiot.
Chet Hayes loves speaking fake patois. So you'll note that Tom Hanks and his partner are not Jamaican.
Yeah,
and
his nor son, is his son.
Son Chet Hayes is also not Jamaican. This is textbook fake patois. Like, you couldn't get this is. You look up fucking fake patois in the dictionary, it's this video of Chet Hayes. This is the funniest fake patois I've ever seen in my life. And I've witnessed a number of hilarious fake patois. Yeah. Because the other level to this story is that Noon and I have a deep and abiding love of fake patois, which goes back many years. But starts with a little band called Das Racist, a now-defunct rap duo out of
Panic
America.
Panic Attack rap, I believe, is the
Flapjack
genre.
Flapjack rap, yeah.
Who is strongly recommended and is really like a key underpinning element of me and Zach's friendship.
If you don't know about Das Racist, now you know.
Yeah.
They have an amazing song called Fake Patois. So just for fun, I thought we'll play just 10 seconds of it.
Just give you a little sous-son.
Yup, got the fake patois. Keres One did a fake patois. Miss Clue got a fake patois. Even Jay-Z did a fake patois. Bad Brains had a fake patois. My man Snow had a fake patois. Even Jim Carrey fuck with the patois. So you know we come through with the fake patois.
Yeah, if you don't know about Snow or Jim Carrey, you should look up Informer by Snow and then Imposter by Jim Carrey. So some
originators
excellent
of the fake patois. OG fake patois. So now that we've come full circle, you understand, you know about fake patois, you know about Chet Hayes, you know that Tom Hanks and his partner Rita Wilson
very white
got coronavirus in Australia, in Queensland, which, again, that's pretty funny. Like, they're going to be fine. they've already, like...
Chet Hanks isn't, though. He's already not fine. That's not corona-related, but he's clearly not fine.
Chet Hanks put out a video basically being like, thanks for all the concern for my parents, like, they're fine. And it's really disappointing because he doesn't speak in a fake patois at any point. But he does at the end say, much love, which is,
you know,
objectively also quite funny. So now that you know the full picture, I'm just going to play that Brad Pitt clip again because I want to hear it one more time.
Oh, be your sister, no devil, no dopey. Everything going to be iry.
Thanks, yep. Chet. Thanks for soothing your parents' fears.
And thanks, Zach, for taking us through that extremely convoluted series of memes and personal private jokes. Yeah, it's good shit.
You are welcome. That was the aforementioned highbrow shit that I bring to this podcast. So Yeah, you're welcome. Do you want to talk about the rest of the series?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, it's okay. So for our main course, we're having viral loaded potato wedges, which
it's so gross.
It is gross, but as is presumably Peter Dutton's like sinuses at the moment. So he is the viral loaded potato wedge that we're eating, because as we have mentioned, he got coronavirus, which is very funny. And also it seems like he was almost certainly contagious at the time of the last cabinet meeting on Tuesday. And Scott Morrison has said he's not going to be tested for coronavirus for some reason. And
because he doesn't want to get a positive response before he gets to see the Sharkies.
Exactly, yeah.
Or to go to the huge Hillsong conference, which is also happening this weekend.
That's the big news, is that the all events, public gatherings of over 500 people have been sort of, I don't think it's exactly banned, but they've been like told not to do it.
Advised against.
Yeah. As of Monday, right? So, and the reason for
why Monday?
Yeah, is because of the Sharks and this Hillsong event, which no doubt will be huge vectors in the spread of the disease, because
because there's going to be one definitely infected person there, at least one.
And, you know, I'm not sure if we talked about this on air, but there was a South Korean church that has been identified as a major cause of the spread in South Korea, and it's because they sit much closer together than a normal church. They are encouraged to go to church even when they're sick, because it like proves their devotion to God. And this is the part that I find kind of amusing, or at least like more, I don't know, whatever, is that they, at the end of every single sentence, they shout, "Amen!" There's like droplet production at a much higher rate than a normal church. But if anyone's ever been to a Hillsong event, it's exactly like that. It's like a fucking mosh pit, but where everyone's got like chastity belts on, in theory. But they're all like screaming and yelling for their favorite like Jesus rock celebrities. And so anyway, I anticipate that that will be a...
It's a very open-mouthed
religious expression. Yeah. I feel like the Sufis, maybe they would be doing all right. They just like spin at distance from one another. They're probably doing all right. Look, the coronavirus.
So go on.
This is now a Sufi podcast. So the news this week has kind of been constant, and at the same time not very much. Like, there's been a lot of speculation about what will they do, what's going to happen, is it going to be a pandemic, and now it's all kind of happened. Like, yes, it is now officially a pandemic, all of these gatherings are banned, and the government has come out with a bunch of like stimulus package that we'll get to in a minute, but we just wanted to talk about like one or two other little sort of like personal stories, I guess. One in particular is a Sydney family who are stuck in Wuhan in China, and they are, as everyone is in Wuhan, not allowed to leave their apartment. But they were cut off from Centrelink, because Centrelink asked them to get a medical certificate to prove that they had coronavirus, but they're not allowed to leave their fucking house, so they can't get a medical certificate. And so they are now stuck overseas and unable to receive any kind of income. And this is a woman and three children who are stuck there. Yeah.
It's on some real Kafka-esque type shit.
For like, real.
Oh, yeah, in order to prove that you exist, you needed to do this thing that you're not allowed to do by the bureaucracy. And this, it definitely echoes in Australia how ScoMo has been talking about people who are out of work and get on the sickness allowance, but in order to do that, you need to go into the Centrelink office in person, and if you've been diagnosed, then obviously you're not allowed
to do
that.
You can't do that, yeah. Yeah, it's very silly. It's almost as if they're more interested in punishing people for being poor than in dealing with coronavirus.
Well, that's it. And this is what, you know, I was kind of getting at before, perhaps not super eloquently, but the way that these kinds of events just put pressure on these systems that are already broken and expose the weaknesses that are already there. Like, this shit is just fucking ridiculous. And it does happen to people, like, on the regular. It's just that now you've got so many more cases coming in, and because of coronavirus, it's newsworthy.
Yeah.
But, like, these are all pre-existing problems that thousands of people have to deal with. So,
another thing is that people are being advised to not take any non-essential trips to remote communities in the Northern Territory. And presumably the same advice applies to remote communities, not in the Northern Territory, but this is what the story is about. There. Yeah. And that's because First Nations people are much more vulnerable to these kinds of diseases. And in the swine flu epidemic a few years ago, the Indigenous people were 11% of cases in Australia, which is six times the national mortality rate. Sorry, there's different stats. They were 11% of cases, and they had six times the mortality of the general population.
Yeah, while comprising roughly 3% of the total population.
Yeah, that's
so
right.
Obviously, that's a massive over-representation.
Yeah.
And, you know, this isn't some fucked up, like, biological or, like, hereditary, like, predisposition. This is structural disadvantage makes you more vulnerable to disease.
That's a good point, actually. There has been some super fucked articles, people being like, oh, this disease targets Asians or whatever, and things like that. That it's just, like, 100% not true.
Just fuck off. But absolutely fuck off with that shit.
But also, like, disease and colonialism, like, have an intertwined history. And if anyone's read the book Guns, Germs, and Steel, like, the whole premise of it is, like, why were there colonizers from Europe who went and destroyed Latin America, South America, all of America, really, rather than the other way around? But he brings up, Jared Diamond, the author, brings up these three things, guns, germs, and steel, and is basically, whatever, it's an interesting book with lots of problems, but it's interesting. But yeah, but like, disease is this like major tool, both purposeful and accidental, of colonial violence, that obviously, like, there was proactive spread of disease by colonists, but also because of our, like, the historical social structure about how the size of communities and cities and, like, the degree to which animals integrated in those environments and all this other stuff, disease was just a huge killer of the people being colonized and invaded. So, and that this is still happening, you know.
Yeah, obviously, like, it's very important to contextualize this kind of thing in the broader history of colonialism.
Yep. And as always, Zach tries to get me not to talk about international pulp, but I just wanted to say, it seems like President of Brazil, Jair Bolsonaro, might have coronavirus. They deny it, but Fox News has reported that he does, so we'll see how that goes. So, you know, get him.
That dude was already notoriously sweaty and live streaming from his house, so I don't know how much it's going to change for him.
Yeah.
But again, officially, it is funny that fascists get coronavirus,
and
that's comedy.
It seems that Trump has also been confirmed to have been exposed to at least one person with coronavirus, who's like photos of him shaking hands with and shit, which is, again, it's very funny. But also, it's funny because Trump is a huge, like, paranoid germaphobe, and so I just think that's, like, extra amusing. But he has said he's not going to be tested, so cool.
I guess we can all rest easy. To be fair, he's also not testing the entirety of the American population as well.
Which actually...
They've got, like, the lowest rate of testing of any developed nation. So they're just doing a great job. If only there was some kind of system...
Like, some
everybody,
kind of federal organization,
like,
that could, like, lead
care,
social responses...
For free.
Maybe spend money to do things.
Where's that money going to come from, Noon?
Yeah. Well, actually, that leads nicely into...
Also, I've bailed out the stock market for $1.5 trillion, but don't tell anybody about that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, thank you. That's actually...
Sorry, did I jump on
your
line?
Next part of the show. It's okay, yeah. So these viral-loaded wedges are loaded with wads of cash, but tiny wads. Because is there something funny about the term tiny wads?
Please tell me more about your tiny wads, Noon.
Okay. Yeah, so obviously one big aspect of this has been the, like, spread of disease, and the other part has been the economic situation and the financial situation. There's been a huge downturn in financial markets across the world, which they are very skeptical about financial markets being used as a, like, equivalent to, like, success of the economy or whatever.
Health,
But they also kind of are, and if not representative of what's going on in, like, actual people's lives, they're at least representative of what the governments pretend is going on in people's lives. And the ASX, the Australian Stock Exchange, and all of the other international stock exchanges just had absolutely terrible week. it's been, there's been a huge crash, and I think there was the biggest one-day drop since 1987, which is huge that it's like been worse than the global financial crisis in 2009, 2010. And... honestly, I think the government, at least in Australia, is vastly more worried about the economy than they are about people dying of coronavirus. That
would be very consistent of them.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's all the Liberal government has ever pretend or said that they care about is like the stock market and the economy. And although they're not actually very good at maintaining them because they have like ideology that doesn't accurately map onto the real world, but like...
Yeah, no, I mean... We have a political system that judges the health of a society by its economic standing, not by how well the people are doing.
Yeah.
And so this is an extremely appropriate response according to that ideology.
Yeah. I definitely agree with that. So anyway, the federal government has come out with a stimulus spend. They've announced that the planned budget surplus is completely gone. It's not going to happen. They're not aiming for it. It's done. Dead, buried, and cremated, as everyone's been saying.
I fucking hate the Australian media.
Yeah, totally, yeah. They just got all these fucking in-jokes that no one likes except themselves.
Stop writing!
It's good advice, Zach. Just listen to our show instead. We will completely adequately replace the entire media environment of Australia.
I love to butcher a description of a meme and then tell people that I'm the only reliable source of news.
Yeah.
Stimulus.
Yeah. So,
Are they stimulating?
They are, there's one major and one minor aspect. So this has been it's going to be $22 billion over 2 years. It's going to be about $17 billion coming out in the next year. And then the other like $5 billion or so in 2021. And a bunch of that is going, a small wad, if you will, of that is going to welfare recipients. And this honestly is a good idea. It's just done in the like most reluctant possible way. So as you may recall, a decade ago there were like $900 checks being mailed out to people because of the Kevin Rudd's stimulus package, and this time there's a much more limited group of people receiving $750, which if you understand the idea of inflation, you'll realize is like
Even less
compared to how much Kevin Rudd was doing. Yep.
Yeah, I think the $900 equals roughly $1,100, adjusting for inflation. So yeah, much stingier, and this isn't going out to just a general section of the population. It's specifically people on welfare, yep. So pensioners and job seekers and so on.
As actual economists have been saying for a long time, if you want to stimulate the economy, the best place to do that is in welfare recipients, because welfare is much too low in this country. These people are, including myself, living week to week on not enough money. And as soon as welfare recipients get money, they tend to spend it on fucking surviving, right?
That doesn't sound nearly as good for the economy as putting it in an offshore bank account or collecting interest or...
Yeah, and so this is actually kind of what I was saying about the stock market being used as this kind of like gauge of the economy, but like offshore bank accounts earning interest on like Ponzi scheme investments count for ASX, but they're bad for people. And so, yeah, the stock exchange is not necessarily a good indicator of, like, the economic health of a country.
Mm. But, I mean, we know, obviously, like, it's sound economic theory that if you give money to the people who most need it, that they are obviously going to spend that.
Yep.
Because they are already, as you say, are living hand to mouth. And there's been a hashtag that has taken off about this on Twitter, which was started by the Australian Unemployed Workers Union. Shout out to that team. They do fantastic work, and we are big fans. They started the hashtag My750, and they were just asking welfare recipients, what are you going to spend this $750 on? And the answers overwhelmingly were, I'm going to spend it on rent.
Yep.
I'm going to spend it on food. I'm going to spend it on urgent medical care, medication that I can't otherwise get.
Yep.
And just day-to-day survival. I'm not going to save this money. I'm not going to invest this money. I'm not going to use it to take a fucking holiday, as some people in the government have suggested. Like, I don't know what the fuck holiday you're taking for $750.
Yeah.
Like, but whatever. So, again, we're coming back to this idea of these people already living on these payments, which are not enough to get by on day-to-day.
So, I think I approve of these payments, even though I think they're inadequate. But I think it's a good idea because these people obviously need the money, and it's going to be good for the economy. As we've seen, actually, since this package went out, the stock market did recover significantly. And also in the US, they've put out a similar package. They're much bigger, and the stock market there went up. So, you know, I do think it's a good idea, even though it's inadequate. But I worry that this might be an excuse for the government to then completely refuse any further action on Newstart. Not that they really need a reason, because they've been doing that for decades, which we've known that Newstart needs to be increased already. But the surplus, which is now like dead, buried, cremated or whatever, in 6 months or a year, whenever the coronavirus sort of dies down, the panic dies down, the surplus is going to be put back in the center of focus by the Conservatives. And they're going to use that as an excuse not to put any more money into social services of any sort. And
even when it literally works to their political advantage.
Exactly. Absolutely.
Like, these people are so driven by ideology that they can't even take the political win from something that conflicts with their beliefs about poor people suffering.
Totally. I say this quite often, but like, Australia is famous throughout the world for negotiating free trade agreements that are bad for us, because we just like believe so hard in fucking free trade that we're willing to screw ourselves for like literally no reason. But yeah, it's... There's so much ideology in this.
Yeah, and it's very interesting, I guess, to see this sort of emergency economic response from the government, and the way that it's sort of, they're forced to engage with the ideas that people have been saying for decades, like they need to do if they want to help Australia like thrive and prosper and for people to have better lives. And obviously raising Newstart is a massive part of that, but in general, just improving conditions for workers, especially like in a casualized workforce. And we have, these are things that they would never in a million years engage if they weren't under a huge amount of like urgent political pressure. Like, this is the only time that they've ever done that. This government has taken any kind of positive steps for people on welfare. And of course it's only a short term interim measure. They would never actually instigate long-term change, but we do have a potluck from a listener about this, listener and friend of the show,
guest appearance on the IPA episode,
member of our Inner Sanctum,
confidant
Lisbeth Latham, who also this week had a piece published in Green Left Weekly, which I highly recommend. That is called "Working Communities Must Not Be Made to Pay for COVID-19 Crisis." Definitely go and check that out. Lisbeth has also submitted a little bit of audio for us, so we're going to play that now.
Potluck, where you bring the snacks.
Hi, it's Lisbeth. I think that when we look at the stimulus package which has been put forward by the government, that it fundamentally underestimates what is actually happening in the economy at the moment and what we're confronted with the coronavirus. Particularly, I think that it assumes that the problem is simply that business won't spend money, and that's not the problem. The problem is going to be that huge proportions of the population are going to be without incomes for potentially an extended period of time. And so the focus of any stimulus should really be about... And ensuring that people have income so they can meet their needs, so they can eat, they can pay their rent, they can pay their bills. And if we don't do that, then the crisis is just going to get deeper and deeper and deeper.
Yeah, totally agree. And I think there's been a lot of discussion about this, about casual workers in particular, who are obviously sort of the most prone to being not given shifts, and also the people who have least reliable income sources.
The whole point of casual loading noon is that you get paid a little bit of extra money, and so you save that up for when you don't have a job anymore.
That's why we have penalty rates on weekends. Yes. Yeah,
thank
of course.
You so much, Christian Porter, for that extremely on point commentary.
And
go on.
No, well, I think Lisbeth's point is really true, that the government is, what they're actually worried about is businesses. And the money going to Newstart recipients is just like a little sprinkling on top of the stimulus package, which is all for business.
Oh, we probably should have provided this context before we played the potluck, but, you know, obviously a majority of the stimulus package is going to business.
Yes.
And part of the whole package is that they have increased the tax write-off threshold for businesses, yep, basically in an attempt to get businesses to spend a bunch of money, buy yourself new equipment that you need or whatever.
Which you may recall was also something that the Abbott government did in 2014 or 15. I think that was like one of the only measures that they got up from their budget because it was one of the few that meant that they would spend more rather than less. So it was something that the rest of the parliament supported.
So as Lisbeth said, and you just reiterated, the government's response shows that what they are worried about is that business won't spend money.
Yes.
This like that's what they consider to be the economic emergency here. Not that a number of people won't be able to work and won't be able to put food in their fucking mouths.
And will get evicted. Yeah. The Reserve Bank of Australia has also put about $6 billion into banks that they've bought debt off those banks, that the debt was looking like it was not going to be profitable. And so the Reserve Bank has just given them basically $6 billion to like not have those bad investments anymore. Which, like, can you imagine what $6 billion might do for fucking New Start recipients?
Yeah, and so I think, again, I'm sure I'm sounding a bit like a broken record here, but the idea that there is some kind of short-term economic fix for this one particular situation and then we will revert to business as usual is so dangerous and so wrong and just obviously bad management of the country. What this situation is doing is exposing the ways in which our economic system is fundamentally broken and massively disadvantages huge portions of the population of this country, and giving a few people $750 helpful over the course of a fortnight, though it may be, is in no way a long-term solution.
Response. Yeah.
And the fact that they acknowledge the fact that they understand, they clearly know that this is the best way to rebuild the economy from the fucking ground up, help the people who need it most. That's how money is going to get back into the economy. Mm. They clearly understand that. Like, what this like little addendum for welfare recipients to the stimulus package shows. It shows that the government fucking understands
that. They know that when they are forced to look at it, honestly, but like they...
But they can't implement it long term. They won't do it because it conflicts with their own fucking political self-interest.
Yeah.
Or not even political self-interest. No, like, it would be hugely like politically
ideology.
Popular.
Yeah.
Yeah, their ideological self-interest, which is very different.
I actually have a hot take, which I really don't want listeners to misinterpret as somehow praising Scott Morrison.
Well, that should be good.
But I think that Australia is actually like extraordinarily lucky that we have him and not Tony Abbott as our prime minister at the moment, because while Scott Morrison is a useless shitbag, he is a door in the breeze. He swings whichever way is going to be good for him. And in this case, that's meant that he's like able to put the stimulus package together. Whereas I suspect that Tony Abbott, regardless of how the stock market was crashing, regardless of what expert economists were telling him, would never have been able to give a single fucking cent to a New Start recipient. Take this as endorsing Scott Morrison. Just be retroactively even more pissed off at Tony Abbott, please.
It's not an endorsement of Morrison. I think it's a demonstration of the fact that he's just got a stronger instinct for political self-preservation than Abbott did.
Yeah.
Abbott, like, was very happy to fall on his fucking sword ideological issues.
Yeah.
Which, and not that Scott Morrison isn't an ideologue in his own way. He definitely is.
Yeah.
But he is much more concerned with maintaining his public image than Abbott, who was, like, happy for people to hate him. Based on his beliefs. I think it's just further evidence that Morrison is basically a spineless, soulless political operator who, as you say, will flap limply whichever way the breeze happens to swish him. So, we've got a bad government. They're doing a bad job of running the country. Obviously, this crisis is awful, but all it is really doing is exposing the many and vicious cracks in our society through which people are continuously falling.
Before we finish up, I just wanted to mention that the Greens have come out with a actually really valuable proposal. And,
you know what this is going to be? Positivity Corner.
Oh, nice. Yeah, we were beforehand. We were like, oh, what Positivity Corner can we have? But anyway, yeah.
Put that sting.
Positivity Corner.
Oh, Yeah. Well, right. So this is a policy that Adam Bandt put forward, which, as we discussed 2 weeks ago, I think, Adam Bandt's been pushing the Green New Deal concept. And although I don't think he's actually said this as an aspect of that, as
no,
you said...
this has been part of his Green New Deal listening tour. So it is...
Cool. Okay, cool.
Yeah, whether or not it's like officially part of like a Green New Deal platform is unclear, but it's definitely part of the conversation that he's sure. trying to have about Green New Deal. And this is what I'll let you fill in the details, but when we were having our conversation about Bandt's proposal about proposal of a Green New Deal, or you know, trying to introduce that into the political conversation, I did a bit of kind of whinging and moaning about not really seeing the things, the actual hard policies that he was proposing as being particularly Green New Deal-y, more being like existing Greens policy that he's then tacked the label onto. This that you're about to talk about, I think, is much more like the meat of what a Green New Deal might actually look like. So, yeah, please tell us.
So this is a $28 billion proposal to build 500,000 new homes that are all solar powered and presumably, you know, high Energy Star ratings and so on. And this would bring 40,000 new jobs, Bandt reckons, over the course of, you know, a couple of years. And
a whole bunch of apprenticeships as well.
Yeah, and that's right, 10% of those jobs he wanted to be apprentices, yeah. And so I think this is a good idea. I think this is the kind of stimulus that the economy really needs. It's like, not exactly, it's not like the NDIS, for example. It's not a structural spend. It is sort of once off, but it's once off over the course of like 3 to 6 years that's going to fundamentally improve the economic situation of the country, but also is actually, it's not oriented at fucking GDP or the stock market or the fucking housing building companies or whatever. It's the idea is to build houses for people to live in and to make that accessible and to make it affordable and
to build them in line with environmental best practice
absolutely.
As well. So it's not just an economic thing, it's also fundamentally an environmental project as well, which is what I think that's the nexus at which real Green New Deal policy sits. So that's why I really love this proposal. I have absolutely no fucking idea at all whether or not there is any kind of realistic chance at this.
None. Yeah, yeah.
But, like, I think that this is absolutely a great direction for Bandt to be pushing the conversation in. And so, credit where it is due.
Mm-hmm.
Positivity where it is due.
Yeah, listeners may have noticed that we haven't mentioned the Labour Party at all on this, because that's what they've been doing, is not mentioning themselves. They've just been like... Yeah, look, government bad, but this is probably good, and just when they're going to very, very, very quietly criticize things. So one thing that they have said that's definitely true is that this stimulus package was needed regardless of coronavirus, and that it's a shame that it's taken this like international emergency for the government to get off their hands and actually do something in terms of like improving the economy. Yep, which is true, but they're not doing a great job, I got to say. And on that unpositive end of our positivity corner, I think that is going to bring us to the end of the show.
Yeah, thank you for tuning in. Another long one this week. I guess we have just become a 1 hour podcast now.
Yeah.
Most people seem to not mind that except me, because it's obviously double the work, but that's okay. That's fine. I'm fine. please follow us on Facebook if you don't already, at Auspulse NACPod. Join the Auspulse Shitposting Facebook group. You
get
can also
on Instagram,
and on Twitter, where we post sporadically and poorly.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you're really enjoying the show and you want to help us out, please recommend us to a friend,
send us to
a family member, or a colleague, or you know, post it on your socials.
If you know someone who's self-isolating with coronavirus, they probably would love like 12 hours worth of us talking about stuff. So you know, send them over there. Yeah.
Please do. And if you really, really like the show and you have a few bucks spare, you can head over to Patreon and support us for as little as $1 a month, and that gets you a monthly bonus episode. We will have one coming out shortly, another bonus episode. And that also gets you access to our private Discord server, where you can chat extra shit and extra Auspol with our lovely patrons.
And us. We're also on
We are
Discord,
also there. Again, posting sporadically and poorly. Thank you so much for tuning in. That's going to do us for this week. Keep on snacking in the free world.
Crunch, crunch.